thanks for coming, everybody, if you hadn't been here already. So our next speaker is Eugenie Scott. She has been both a researcher and an activist in the creationism slash evolutionary controversy for over 25 years, and can address many components of this controversy, including educational, legal, scientific, religious, and social issues. She holds 9 honorary degrees from McGill, Rutgers, Montpelier, the University of New Mexico, Ohio State, and the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, Colorado College, the University of Missouri-Columbia, and Chapman University. Proven time and time again, Eugenie is a dynamic speaker. She offers stimulating and thought-provoking presentations, as well as entertaining lectures and workshops, which is why we're glad to bring her back for her second appearance at Free Thought Festival. I'm glad to introduce Eugenie Scott.
Well, good evening. I'm really, really glad to be back in Wisconsin. I was talking with some people in the front, and they didn't know that I grew up in Wisconsin. 51 years ago, I was a college sophomore in Celery Hall. So I feel like I'm home. But even though I went to a really good high school in Milwaukee, went on Milwaukee Riverside, go East. And it was really, really, I literally coasted for my first 2 years at UWM on what I had learned in English classes at Riverside. I mean, it was a really, really great high school. I never learned evolution. Most people of my generation didn't get taught evolution in their junior high and high school. Now, things have improved. Things have definitely improved. But I had to wait until I got to the university before I learned about the E word, because my high school teachers were reluctant to teach it, and it wasn't part of the curriculum, and it definitely wasn't in the textbooks. Like I said, things have gotten better, but there still are a lot of problems with the teaching of evolution in the public schools. There have been over 70, that's 70, anti-evolution bills proposed in various states in the last decade or so. Now, you know this if you've been on the National Center for Science Education website, because we have all this stuff there, and you can get a really depressing education by going to that website at intervals. And if you look at these various bills that have been coming out over the last few decades, there's an interesting pattern to them, which was illustrated in a very important paper to come out in Science Magazine in December of 2015. This was written by my former National Center for Science Education colleague, Nick Motzke. And what he did was a very interesting thing. He took the texts of all of the bills, the anti-evolution bills that had been submitted to state legislatures around the country since 2004. That was sort of our starting point. He took all of these bills and he broke them into phrases, and he did a phylogenetic analysis. He did an evolutionary analysis on the text of those bills, tracing phrases through time, so to speak, as the evolutionary tree of these bills, shall we say, branched and split through time as different states picked up different ideas. He traces the evolution of these bills from 2004 to 2015. Now, this is how you read these charts. Time runs along the bottom from early to recent. At the left is 2004, at the right is 2016. The bills themselves are indicated at the ends of the branches. So this is a South Dakota bill from 2014. This is an Iowa bill from 2009. You kind of get to see how these bills work. The ancestor of all of these bills is a group of bills originating in Alabama in 2004, okay? Now, just to give you an idea about how to read these trees, here's a tree showing bills where the term evolution is specifically mentioned. Now, this is almost all the bills, clearly. This lineage of bills here, Texas is in the South Dakota bill, this lineage doesn't mention evolution, nor does this lineage of mostly Oklahoma bills, but, you know, this whole analysis was about anti-evolution bills, so duh, evolution is going to occur. The word evolution will occur in all of these bills, pretty much. But anyway, that's That's what this tree is all about. It shows this branching and splitting lineage of the laws dealing with anti-evolution since 2004. Now, all of these post-2004 bills arose after a Supreme Court decision in 1987 that struck down the teaching of something called creation science. In striking down the, In striking down the teaching of sectarian religion in public schools, the court commented the teachers could certainly teach all scientific theories about the origins of humankind. You just couldn't teach religious ones. You know, you could teach all the alternatives to religion, to evolution, that's not a problem. Thing is, there aren't any scientific alternatives. The only scientific view of the history of the universe, the history of living things, is evolution. But Justice Brennan wrote that, of course, teachers can teach all secular views that are alternatives to evolution and so forth. Well, creationists considered creation science, which is what these bills were all about, creationists considered creation science to be a scientific theory, but obviously it was struck down in the courts. And so they couldn't use that anymore, so they came up with another scientific theory, intelligent design. The idea was that even if you couldn't teach creation science, because the Supreme Court had spoken, you could at least teach intelligent design, and that would balance out evolution. We see this strategy in a group of bills appearing from about 2004 to 2009, collectively called academic freedom bills. These promote the teaching of creationism in the guise of protecting a teacher's academic freedom to teach all the evidence or the full range of scientific views. The phrase full range of scientific views comes from a sense of the Senate amendment to the 2001 No Child Left Behind bill that was put forth by Senator Santorum. A second creationist approach was encouraged by a dissent to that Supreme Court decision, Edwards versus Aguilar, by Justice Scalia. Scalia wrote that teachers could teach the evidence against evolution, which became another organizing strategy. I need to explain that creationists think dichotomously. There's either creationism or evolution. So evidence against evolution is evidence for creationism. So to their way of thinking, if you just teach that evolution is crappy science, you are in effect teaching that creationism is good science and creationism is the correct view. So evidence against evolution laws have been part of the anti-evolution movement for a very long time. But they became codified, shall we say, with the Santorum Amendment, and then the creationists picked up Scalia's dissent to Edwards and really codified that in their strategy. So the evidence against evolution strategy was another one of these post-Edwards versus Aguilar strategies that creationists hit upon. In the mid-2000s, the Scalia position began to be emphasized in legislation where a new generation of bills called the Science Education Acts were more explicit about teachers teaching strengths and weaknesses of evolution and similar wording reflecting the supposed evidence against evolution. Now, there was, of course, overlap. The academic freedom wording didn't totally go away, but the full range of views encouraging the teaching of intelligent design seemed to largely fade away in the mid-2000s. Well, why was that? I think the major reason is a lawsuit that took place in 2005 where parents in a small community in central Pennsylvania sued their school board over the teaching of intelligent design. Had they lost, the legislative landscape would look very different today, and other aspects of science education would also have been affected. Kitzmiller versus Dover. No, not Darwin. Kitzmiller versus Dover was at the time a very large news story with all of the networks and major print publications covering the case. Even The Daily Show had a feature on intelligent design the week the trial began. Nova produced a 2-hour documentary in 2007 that received a Peabody Award and also an award from the American Association for the Advancement of Science for scientific journalism. Here's a clip. If you haven't seen Judgment Day, check it out. It's very good. The conflict heated up in 2004 when high school biology teachers wanted to get the newest edition of the textbook they'd been using, Miller and Levine's Practice Hall Biology. School board member Bill Buckingham accused the book of being laced with Darwinism. He proposed that the standard biology textbook be supplemented with Of Pandas and People, which he said would balance evolution in the standard textbook. It would present the view of intelligent design. Now, you were given a quick little summary of intelligent design in the clip, but very quickly, it's basically one idea, which is found in two forms. Michael Behe's irreducible complexity idea and William Dembski's design inference or specified complexity both deal with the idea that really complicated things in nature are either too improbable or too complex to occur through natural causes. Therefore, they have to be the result of intelligent production. There's an intelligence that is responsible for complicated things like the blood clotting mechanism or the bacterial flagellum or the cosmological constants and so forth and so on. These ideas have not stood the test of time, shall we say. Scientists have rejected them. But I think it's important to reflect upon one very significant aspect of intelligent design, which really violates the whole idea of science. I mean, what we're trying to do in science is explain the natural world using natural causes. What the intelligent design people are saying is that there's a whole class of natural phenomena that we are just taking off the table of science because we are declaring them in advance to be impossible to explain through natural causes. That is a science stopper. If you don't look for a natural cause, you will never find one. So even things that we have not yet explained, we cannot say they are unexplainable and claim we're doing science. But that is what the intelligent design people want us to do with these very complex biological phenomena. It's a point of view that has been roundly rejected in the scientific community. Now, the intelligent design people are very careful to try to distinguish their views from an older form of creationism called creation science. In creation science, which was the topic of that Supreme Court decision I mentioned a little bit earlier, in creation science you're dealing with pretty much a biblical literalist point of view. A 24-hour day creation, the most common form of it taking place relatively recently in thousands of years, 6,000 to 10,000 years ago. But basically, the idea of creation science is the Christian doctrine of special creation, that God poofs into existence things as we see them today. So the solar system has always gone around the sun, and the galaxies have always been where they are, living things. Barnacles have always been barnacles, giraffes have always been giraffes. There has been no common ancestry of living things. There has been no evolution. When you examine the precepts of intelligent design, it really is a subset of creation science, in the sense that everything that intelligent design claims pre-exists in creation science. There's nothing new in intelligent design that is not already in creation science. But there are claims that creation science proponents make that are outside of intelligent design. Intelligent design people rarely spend any time talking about the age of the Earth, for example. Intelligent design folks are agnostic on whether the Earth is billions of years old or thousands of years old. I think it makes a difference scientifically myself, but they apparently don't feel that. The idea that intelligent design is a subset of creation science was very important to our argument in Kitzmiller versus Dover, which I'll try to explain. Now, back to Dover. During the summer of 2004, the Dover School Board told the science department that they should read the Pandas and People book and watch an intelligent design video called Icons of Evolution, and then come back and report on the suitability of these products for the classroom. The teachers were unimpressed. They unanimously said, no, we don't think these things are suitable for the classroom. Thank you anyway. But in the fall of 2004, the board told them that unless they agreed to use pandas and people, the board would not approve the purchase of the new textbooks. So they basically held the purchase of the Miller and Levine textbook ransom for the adoption of pandas and people. This, by the way, is very, very rare. You hardly ever find a school board that engages in this kind of micromanagement of the curriculum. Teachers continued to resist, although the board was not willing to compromise in any fashion. In October of 2004, the board passed a policy that read, students will be made aware of gaps slash problems in Darwin's theory and of other theories of evolution, including but not limited to intelligent design. When Nick Motzke came into my office one day in the fall of 2004 saying, here's Dover, Pennsylvania, they've got this policy, and he read it to me. I said, read it to me again. And he read it to me. So this was not written by the English department, was it? I think the supporters of intelligent design would be quite surprised to hear that it's a type of evolution, for starters. But you get the idea. This is denigration of evolution and a directive to the teachers that they're supposed to teach intelligent design. The next month, the teachers did a very brave thing. They notified the board that they were unwilling to teach intelligent design, to treat it as equal to evolution, and that the board is going to have to be a lot more specific about exactly what they're supposed to teach. As described by biology teacher Jennifer Miller, who's the lady in the lower right, in the December 2015 issue of Reports of the NCSE, the board countered by telling teachers they had to read that statement that they mentioned in the clip from Judgment Day, that the teachers had to read the statement to the students before beginning any lesson on evolution. Here's where the teachers did something that was really, really brave. They said, no, we will not violate our professional integrity, our professional standards as science educators by reading the statement. Now this was incredibly brave. Some of it, it's a union district, yes, but most of the teachers weren't tenured. And they could very easily have been fired without cause whatsoever. They were still in their evaluation year. This was a very, very brave thing for the teachers to do. The Dover teachers, we deserve our admiration. Well, there wasn't anything to do, frankly, but take the board to court because the board refused to compromise on any issue. Their NCSE was working with a number of parents in the community, and we had plaintiffs who were willing to bring a suit. Let me just say that nobody in the right mind wants to bring a lawsuit on these issues. Lawsuits, you heard the Judgment Day comment, they divide communities, they set people against each other, they're enormously expensive, they take a huge amount of energy and distract from the real job of education. I mean, if we could have solved, not we, but if the people of Dover could have solved this issue without going to trial, they'd have done it. They tried for a year and a half, they were unable to. A lawsuit came about only because it was the only recourse. And I just want, you know, the National Center for Science Education is a very small organization, and we are not trigger happy. We're not about to just go around suing things just because it's fun. It's not fun at all. It was an exhausting year. And, you know, it worked out really well. Always spoiled the punchline, didn't it? But you don't do it just on a whim. Our team consisted of NCSE, the ACLU, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and a large law firm based in Philadelphia, Pepper Hamilton. One of NCSE's legal advisory committee was a partner there. We filed on December 18. The trial began in September of 2005, and it took place over 6 weeks. On the other side was the Thomas More Law Center from Michigan, whose motto is the Sword and Shield of People of Faith, led by Richard Thompson. Now, why couldn't we just go to the judge and say, Judge, this Dover policy is going to result in teaching really bad science. Tell the board to knock it off. Well, you can't do that because there is no law that says you can't teach bad science. The only way we could stop this policy was dealing with legal issues. The legal issues are constitutional issues. The constitutional issues are issues having to do with religion. Because there is a law that says you can't advocate religion in the public schools. It's called the First Amendment. The First Amendment has the Establishment Clause that prohibits a public entity from promoting religion, and it has the Free Exercise Clause that inhibits a government agency from inhibiting religion. Taken together, the Establishment and Free Exercise Clauses mean that public agencies such as schools have to be religiously neutral. What the court held in that Supreme Court decision against creation science that I mentioned, what the court held in the Edwards case is that the advocacy of creation science in the public schools violated the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. Courts have been very firm that schools cannot advocate religion. Creationism is religion, therefore it can't be advocated. Creation science is religion, therefore it can be advocated. So what we were interested in doing, obviously, is linking intelligent design to creation science, because the judge and all the Supreme Court had already ruled that creation science is religious advocacy. Now, the defense side, because of course these are constitutional issues, what the defense's lawyers had to demonstrate is that teaching intelligent design was being done in Dover for a secular reason, not for a religious reason. There was a pedagogical reason for teaching intelligent design. It was going to give the students a broader view, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the fact that intelligent design has religious implications doesn't in itself make it impossible to teach. As long as there is a secular pedagogical reason for teaching it, you know, even if the implications were religious, that wouldn't be enough to stop it. I mean, you know, evolution has religious implications, right? But it's still taught because it's a valid science. There's a secular reason for teaching evolution. The other side had to demonstrate that there was a secular reason for teaching idea. To do so, they had to demonstrate that intelligent design was valid science. They had to get their science experts on the stand to demonstrate that there was a there, that there was a scientific basis, an empirical and a logical and a scientific basis to intelligent design. And they also wanted to show that evolution was questionable science, that there were the weaknesses of evolution. If you remember the policy of the Dover School Board, gaps/problems in evolution. So they needed to hit evolution and boost intelligent design. And they also had to, they had to show that evolution was questionable science. Now, on our side, what we had to show is that, to the contrary, intelligent design is a religious view. We needed to show that intelligent design was just a reworked, a rehashed, a renamed creation science. Because as they say, Edwards versus Aguilar had already declared that creation science was unconstitutional to teach. So if we could tie intelligent design to creation science, we could go home happy. We had to demonstrate, therefore, that there was no valid secular reason for teaching intelligent design. We had to show that intelligent design wasn't science. Science explains things, explains nature by in reference to natural causes. Intelligent design, however much they might deny, intelligent design does require supernatural causes. I mean, nobody really thinks the intelligent designer is a time-traveling biochemist. I mean, it's God, right? The fact that intelligent design requires supernatural intervention takes it right out of the realm of science from the get-go. We also had to show that the fact claims of intelligent design were also wrong. We had to show that when Michael Behe talks about the bacteria flagellum, he is wrong about natural selection. He is wrong about the inability of a natural process like natural selection to produce something like the bacterial flagellum. So as the clip said, there was a lot of science in this program. We also had to defend evolution. because of that gap slash problems and evolution aspect of the policy, we had to be sure that the judge understood that evolution was sound science and didn't need balancing because it was somehow questionable. There was a lot of science presented to the judge. As Margaret Talbot said in The New Yorker, it was like the biology class you wish you could have taken. At the end of the first day of testimony, we had Ken Miller on the stand, who was an excellent science communicator and very enthusiastic. If any of you ever heard Ken Miller speak or watched any of his videos, yeah, he's great, isn't he? He's just terrific. Well, after Ken, you know, sort of did his usual bouncing, yeah, we were all for science. I mean, he's just great to watch. You know, this is a whole day of this and lots of slides of flagella and biochemical systems and everything. The judge, called for an end and said, class dismissed. It really was. I learned a lot too, but I know this stuff. In preparation for the Dover trial, NCSE scoured its archives and found a Students for Origins research article from 1981 reporting that the Foundation for Thought and Ethics was preparing a biology textbook. This textbook was described as being sensitively written to present both evolution and creation while limiting discussion to scientific data. Now, this, of course, is vintage creation science, naturally. Creation science also supposedly deals only with scientific data. They claim they can demonstrate the truth of special creationism through science. Now, this Foundation for Thought and Ethics textbook was not to appear for many, many years. This is 1981, remember, so this is just very, very early. We thought that this was the ancestor of Pandas and People, because Foundation for Thought and Ethics published Pandas and People, talking about a creation, we thought, yeah, geez, if we could get some of the early manuscripts of this book, dollars to donuts, we'd be able to show the link between intelligent design and creation science, and boy, did we ever. The lawyers subpoenaed all early manuscripts of Pandas and People, and to their credit, the folks at the Foundation for Thought and Ethics coughed them up. We ended up with six manuscripts. 1983, Creation Biology, 1986, Biology and Creation. You're not going to have to memorize this, don't worry, but just to give you an idea of the temporal distribution of these manuscripts. Biology and Origins, all of these first three manuscripts, you know, they're very creationist-sounding titles, do they not? And then in 1987, comes the first book that's titled Of Pandas and People. And then a little bit later on in 1987, there are two manuscripts, which we cleverly call 1987-1 and 1987-2, both titled Of Pandas and People. In 1989, the first published version of Pandas and People came out, 1993, the second edition. Now, my colleague Wesley Ellsbury wrote a nice little script. Well, first of all, of course, we scanned all of these books and OCR'd them. And then Wesley wrote a little script to trace through various 5 and 10 word phrases to document that this was actually one continuous manuscript in several different forms, because that was necessary to prove that, you know, this was a evolutionary trail, so to speak. And then he did some very simple word counts. How many times does the word creationism occur? How many times does the phrase intelligent design occur? And there's a very interesting thing that happens in 1987. Now, boys and girls, what happened in 1987? The Supreme Court case, right? Between the first 1987 manuscript and the second 1987 manuscript, we infer the Supreme Court said, nah, you can't teach creation science. So all of a sudden, the phrase creationism or cognates disappeared. And suddenly, people were talking about intelligent design. The judge thought that was interesting. We also were able to show a very interesting evolution of a particular sentence that we became. We almost had it tattooed on ourselves. We were so delighted with it. In 86, Biology and Creation, we find creationism defined. Creation means the various forms of life began abruptly through the agency of an intelligent creator with distinctive features already intact. Fish with fins and scales, birds with feathers, beaks, and wings. In 1987, the wording remains essentially in Biology and Origins. It's also present in the first draft of the book entitled Of Pandas and People, hence the arrow there. That's the first draft of Pandas and People. This is 1987. I remind you of the Supreme Court Edwards decision, striking down creation science as being legal to teach. And then the second 1987 Pandas manuscript says, intelligent design means the various forms of life began abruptly through an intelligent agency with their distinctive features already intact. Are we ready to chant it now? Fish with fins and scales, birds with feathers, beaks and wings, etc. I don't think this was an accident. Neither did the church. So we were able to demonstrate through this and a number of other ways that intelligent design was really just a reworked version of creation science and therefore unconstitutional to teach. Now, Kitzmiller wasn't a case one totally on the science, although the science was important. Now remember that the real issue was whether ID is religion, and ideally that the school board had religious intent for passing the policy. We got a lot of help from the actions of school board members who, among other things, had made religious arguments during several school board meetings discussing textbooks and discussing the intelligent design policy. All the school board members said, oh, no, no, we have no interest whatsoever in promoting religion. It was just for the pedagogical reasons of improving science education in Dover that we want to pass this policy. And recordings of school board meetings mysteriously disappeared. So it just became a he said, she said. We had reporters and we had citizens who had attended those meetings and said, no, no, you talked about Jesus in the school board meeting. I mean, come on. And they said, no, not us, nobody. So, you know, who's telling the truth here? A judge doesn't know, right? Defense witnesses William Buckingham and Alan Bonsall also did not endear themselves to the judge when it became very clear that they had been evasive and, at worst, lied under oath during their depositions. When deposed, both of them claimed they had no idea where the money to purchase of Pandas and People had come from. The 60 copies of Pandas and People had been donated to the school board, and nobody knew where the money came from. Except, of course, that in discovery we came across a check written out to Donald Bonsall from Bill Buckingham for $60 to purchase, as the memo says, Pandas and People. You know, little things like that. You know, judges get real testy when they think you've lied under oath. And the judge, you can, by the way, read the whole court transcripts on the NCSC website. And if you read that day, they kind of scuttle and oh, we read it, it was really long. This guy back there loves it. When you read this transcript, it is pretty startling because the judge waited until our guy did the cross-examination, and they said, I have a couple of questions, which must have scared the pants off of them, you know. The defense witnesses, I want to ask the witness a few questions, which is very rare. Judges don't usually ask the witness questions. And he just filleted him. I mean, he was not a happy camper at that point. A real turning point was the discovery of some footage from a local TV station where William Buckingham admitted that his intent was to balance evolution with creations. Thanks, Dex. I'm sorry about that. Anyway, he said, yes, I feel that we should be balancing evolution with something such as creationism. We played this for the judge. And, you know, it was kind of hard for the school board to really defend themselves against things like that. Well, you know what happened. Science won, intelligent design lost, and the little gray-haired, hello, come back. The little gray-haired lady over there in the corner was grinning for an exceedingly important and good reason. It was a huge victory. The judge granted the plaintiffs $2 million in court costs, which I suspect made a lot of school districts around the country swallow hard when thinking about passing similar policies. Now, remember, Kitzmiller was not appealed. It is precedent only in the Middle District of Pennsylvania, which is about this wide. But it is such a strong and persuasive decision that it has been extremely influential even outside of the state of the District of Pennsylvania. There has been no other intelligent design trial since then, and I don't think that there would be. We all really wish that Kitzmiller had been appealed, because it would have been a really great test. It would have been a really great case to go to an appeals court with, and then it would be precedent over a much wider area. But Dover has been extremely influential, mostly for what didn't occur, not for what did occur. The Kitzmiller decision was so strong, so solid, so thorough, that the thought of requiring the teaching of intelligent design was just shelved by opponents. In 2005, we knew that Pennsylvania, Indiana, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Utah legislators were poised to introduce legislation requiring the teaching of ID. New York, by the way, had already done so, though it failed, and doubtless there were many other states and local districts that similarly would have passed such requirements, because before Kitzmiller, there had been ID-friendly legislation introduced in almost every state. I think we can assume that these bills would have had a much greater chance of being passed if a federal district court had decided that ID was legal to teach. Motzke's analysis of legislation that I began with suggests that topically, the recent evolution of anti-evolution legislation began in 2004 with a focus on evolution and origin of life. That's the green section there. The original academic freedom states, a policy originating in Ouachita Parish, Louisiana in 2006 influenced a second major wave where global warming and human cloning were added to evolution and origin of life. That's the red section there. And most recently, we're seeing a yet more subtle anti-evolutionary approach of being very unspecific about what topics teachers should single out for teaching the strengths and weaknesses of. That's the gray ones at the top. Now, it's only more subtle because only with a historical perspective are these bills recognizable as anti-evolution bills. I think this is one of the reasons why Motzke's paper is so important. It's going to show up in the next lawsuit, I pretty much guarantee. Notice there have only been a couple of bills since Kitzmiller that have mentioned intelligent design. That's the blue ones kind of in the middle there. I think it's safe to say that if Kitzmiller had gone the other way, if ID had been declared to be legal to teach, we would see a whole lot more blue on that diagram. I put together a little graphic showing the states that have had academic freedom or science education bills introduced since 2005, as well as those that would be likely candidates for passing ID-friendly legislation. Red is the states where legislation has been introduced since Kitzmiller, not necessarily passed, which makes it likely, I think, that pro-ID legislation would be introduced. And pink is states where ID-friendly legislation has been introduced at some time in the recent past. And that doesn't leave a whole lot of states. There are many districts around the country, in addition to states, that have flirted with intelligent design as well. If Kitzmiller had gone the other way, I think that those states and districts might very well have reintroduced pro-intelligent design legislation. The trickle-down for Kitzmiller would have had serious consequences, not just in terms of legislation, but in other ways as well. In one category is science education standards. Now, many people don't understand about the science education standards movement. The standards and accountability movement took shape in 1989. This is nothing that Obama invented. This was started in 89 under the presidency of the first Governor Bush, George Bush. The National Governors Association and the Council of States School Officers joined together to recommend that states drop state standards in English language, arts, history, math, and science. And experts would write these state standards, which would be models that that individual states could adopt. There was no national standards at all. They were just advisory. We're really dedicated in this country to decentralized education. So this was not like an imposition of national standards. The national science education standards were very popular. They were well accepted, and most states used the early 90s NSES to craft their own state standards in the 1990s and 2000s. And because the national standards were written by the National Academy of Sciences, evolution was just included as one of the topics that needs to be taught in junior high and high school. And what happened after that is the National Center for Science Education had a lot of fights during the 90s and 2000s over the inclusion of evolution in state science standards. What happened very interestingly in the early 2000s is where states that used to in the 1990s promote the inclusion of creation science in state standards started promoting the inclusion of intelligent design instead. And we could see this morphing in a number of states. An example of this would be the state of Ohio. You know, I'm actually going to skip this because I'm getting kind of, I'm running out of time. Suffice to say that had Kitzmiller versus Dover going the other direction, if ID had been declared legal to teach, we would have expected a great deal more inclusion of intelligent design at the state science education standards. Today there's a second state set of national advisory standards, the Next Generation Science Standards, the NGSS. This came on the scene in 2013. They have not been accepted with as much enthusiasm as the NSES. Various political reasons, including confusing the NGSS with Common Core. Even the partner states that helped to write the NGSS did not all adopt the NGSS. And the reasons had to do with the inclusion of evolution, but also the inclusion of anthropogenic climate change. Well, just move along here. Science textbooks also are an area in which, had Kitzmiller gone the other direction, we could expect to see the inclusion of unscientific ideas. Textbook publishers, when told by a state, teach X instead of Y, salute smartly and write their books accordingly. This is a business, and they will sell the books that include the materials that the states want. If the states say include ID, the textbooks will have ID. And we can pretty much assume that students would be even more confused by having an authoritative source like a classroom textbook, including something like intelligent design. Now, Kitzmiller versus Dover stopped the efforts to require the teaching of intelligent design, but it did not stop the anti-evolution movement. There is no shortage of anti-science education activity in the United States these days. All of these bills were submitted in 2016, and it's only April. All of these bills object to the teaching of evolution, of climate change, or both. Intelligent design was an effort to mask a religious foundation of creationism so that it could be taught in state schools. The anti-evolution effort continues in state and local policies and state standards disputes, and there's pressure on teachers in many parts of the country. So the anti-evolution movement certainly has not gone away, but it would have been a lot worse if Kitzmiller had ended in a judge deciding that this was a constitutional inclusion in the science classroom. We owe a lot to Kitzmiller versus Dover. And to John E. Jones III, a Republican practicing Christian judge who has admitted to having no more than a liberal arts education in science, who listened with an open mind to the science, to the philosophy of science, to the history, and applied the law fairly. In my opinion, and the opinion of the science community, came to the correct decision about intelligent design's unsuitability for the public school science classroom. You can find out a lot more about Kitzmiller versus Dover, about the creation-evolution controversy. You go to the legal cases link here at ncse.com. You can read all the transcripts. You can read the depositions. We have a great number of documents online about Kitzmiller versus Dover, and check out the blog too. My colleagues do a lot of good writing. Thank you for inviting me to be part of the